Good morning. Hi. Good morning. So, you saying hi too? Yeah, right. So this morning I'm going to talk about Bodhisattva vow. In all Mahayana temples, after a talk, there are the four Bodhisattva vows. The first of which is, and we chant that in a 45 minutes or an hour or so, depending on how long I talk, right? Sentient beings are numberless. I vow to free them. This is Mahayana. This is a Mahayana vow. This Mahayana vow is one of two changes in Buddhism that took place about 400 years after Buddha's death. Buddhism, luckily, has had a lot of revolutions, quiet revolutions. Luckily, because we need those. We need to be having a continual internal revolution, a quiet, gentle one. Or we turn it into the religion of the past. The religion of the past is dead. It's not alive. So Buddhism has had one every 300 or 400 years, but it's better to have one every 3 or 4 seconds. Much healthier. Much healthier. Much more dynamic. But I take what I can get, right? I'm a Buddhist teacher, so every 300 or 400 years. So this revolution that took place with the birth of the Mahayana, the first component of the revolution was that the Bodhisattva replaced the Arhat. And some of you know this very well. The Arhat. The Arhat was a person who sequestered himself. Could have been her, but mostly him. And through arduous practice, through one lifetime or two lifetimes or three lifetimes, attained enlightenment. And the Mahayana then switched that and said, everybody has a Buddha nature. The Buddha nature is already here in all of us. You don't have to go off and go away from the world and give up everything. You can still have a little some fun in the world. You can still enjoy the world. You can still be of the world. So that's the first part of the Mahayana revolution. The second part is that the way to do that is the way to realize your Buddha nature, your still nature, your enlightened nature, is to help all beings. Help all beings. Sentient beings are numberless. I vow to free them. That's the way to do it. So I'm going to read something from the Theravadan tradition, the early tradition, which is still practiced, and which is good practice too, and then from the Mahayana tradition. So from the Nikayas, the early stuff, Buddha says to the first 60 of his disciples and who had attained enlightenment, and they had practiced hard with him for many years and shunned the world, shunned women. Excuse me, but that was the deal then. Shunned women and all the seductions that went along with women. Go forth, O bhikkhus, for the good of the many, for the happiness of the many, out of compassion for the world, for the good, benefit and happiness of people and celestial beings. Let not two go by one way. Teach the Dharma, excellent in the beginning, excellent in the middle, excellent in the end. Proclaim the noble life, altogether perfect and pure. Work for the good of others. You have done your duties. So this is after years of arduous meditation, arduous dealing with all kinds of sense desires, and finally attaining what they called then, and what we still sometimes call, the nirvanic state. So those 60 bhikkhus were special people. In contrast to that, we have Shantideva. Shantideva, the Mahayana teacher 500 years later, who says nothing about doing anything other than this. This is the practice. This is the practice of awakening, he says. For all those ailing in the world, until their every sickness has been healed, may I myself become for them the doctor, the nurse, the medicine itself. Raining down a flood of food and drink, may I dispel the ills of thirst and famine. And in the ages marked by scarcity and want, may I myself appear as drink and sustenance. For sentient beings poor and destitute, may I become a treasure ever plentiful and lie before them closely in their reach, a varied source of all that they might need. My body thus, and all my goods besides, and all my merits gained and to be gained, I give them all away, withholding nothing, to bring about the benefit of beings. Like the earth and the pervading elements, enduring like the sky itself endures, for boundless multitudes of living beings may I be their ground and sustenance. Thus, for everything that lives, as far as are the limits of the sky, may I provide their livelihood and nourishment until they pass beyond the bonds of suffering. And if you've read Shantideva, and some of you have, this is what he says over and over again. He doesn't say anything about doing zazen, anything about meditation. The practice is to be there for others. So we're Zen Mahayana, though. And my first teacher said, and you guys have heard me say this before, he said, yes, our practice is Theravadin and our attitude is Mahayana. And some of you know what that means. Our practice is Theravada. Our practice is Theravada and our attitude is Mahayana. We do this practice. We believe that through this meditation practice, through this clearing, cleansing practice, we can be better bodhisattvas. We can be better available to each other. But our attitude is that all beings have the Buddha nature, that we want to reach out to all of them right now. So we do both at the same time, which is somewhat of a quandary. Should we purify ourselves first? Well, how many years will it take? How many lifetimes will it take? Should we reach out now? I mean, someone's in need now. Am I going to wait till I've meditated and all got all cleared up to help you when you're really hurting? So this is a quandary in Mahayana Zen. Good quandary. And of course, there's not a specific answer to it except what Suzuki Roshi said. We're Theravada in our attitude. I mean, excuse me, in our practice. Maybe sometimes we are in our attitude. And Mahayana in our attitude. So I've told this story before, but not for a while. Probably not since you left. Told this story before of being young. I was young. And I went to a peace march in my hometown. This was Vietnam War, right? Vietnam War. This was 1967. That's a while ago, right? 1967, I went to a Vietnam peace march. I've been practicing hard. Maybe too hard, should have been soft, but I didn't know then. What did I know? I was just in my early 20s. And Suzuki Roshi said, he had so many of us who were just in our late teens, early 20s, and he said, "Well, you boys need hard practice. Here, lift these stones. Here, go sit." He said, "Sit for a couple more hours. I'm leaving. You boys need hard practice." There were some girls there too, but he didn't say that. He actually always would have the girls go lie down. that was what, not always, but that's what he did a lot. You may think that's sexism, but that was him. I don't know, you know, it's a different culture. So So I've been practicing. Then I was back at my school, my college, which I dropped out of after practicing for 3 years, finishing up, being a good boy, trying to be a good boy. But I couldn't be too good a boy because of the Vietnam War. I mean, who could? And so I went to the Peace March, and Hubert Humphrey was coming to speak. And we did the Peace March because we knew about Hubert Humphrey, and we knew about Lyndon Johnson and Hubert Humphrey and all that stuff, right? And I thought of Hubert Humphrey as being Lyndon Johnson's lackey. But I also had a lot of compassion for Hubert Humphrey because I knew he'd done good things, and I knew that Lyndon Johnson was very overbearing by nature. So I went to the Peace March. I meditated in the morning. I felt good when I got up. I felt I could be calm the whole time. And I felt compassion for Hubert Humphrey because he'd done so many good things. And here this big man was sort of bullying him around. That was my thought. And then I went, and I couldn't get in the auditorium to hear them speak, so I had to hear him speak. And he was saying all these things that made me really mad. My calmness almost vanished immediately when he talked about liberating the Vietnamese. And you know, I was just boiling. I was also hurting inside because I had known some Vietnamese. I had some Vietnamese friends who were the Viet Cong. And so I was hurting, I was boiling, and then Hubert Humphrey went to leave the auditorium, and the first thing I knew, I was with a group of people who was chasing him. I don't know how that happened. I was so calm, I was so still, and there I was chasing Hubert Humphrey. Oh, and he was not in very good shape. And we were only about 20, you know, we were pretty good shape. Oh, no, 1967, I was 24, but still in pretty good shape, right? And then what did we see? The riot cops. The riot cops were there. They were in full uniform. They were right in front of us. They were a huge wall, and we had to stop. We couldn't catch them. I don't know what we would have done if we caught them. Jeez, I don't know. It all happened so fast. You know how sometimes our emotions take over and something happens so fast that we don't know anything? That's really not what we're talking about when we say beginner's mind. Really not. But the riot guards were there. So I stopped. I wasn't a fool. I didn't want to get beaten, right? I stopped. And then I went home and I thought to myself, oh, what did I do? Where did my zazen mind go? Where did my practice go? And I thought to myself, get back to the monastery. Get thee to a nunnery, Tim. Get thee to a nunnery. So I finished my classes and I went right back to Tassajara. That's the Zen monastery. And right back there, I thought, I'm not ready for this. I'm not ready for this. I can't do this. Big shock. Big shock. So that was many, many years ago. Many, many years ago. And, you know, with compassion, when we were talking about it in our morning study group, we were talking about the fact that it's pretty easy to be compassionate for the people who are part of our tribe, who are part of our nation, who are part of our country, who are part of our value system. But those others are weird. It's hard to be compassionate to those weird people. And they're always the others who are weird. And that's hardwired instinct, self-preservation. So that the compassion that Buddha is talking about is the compassion that somehow goes beyond the hardwiring. And sometimes we can do it and sometimes we can't. And, of course, sometimes, even within our own tribe, it's hard to be compassionate to the people who are the very closest to us. The people who are really close to us are the ones we can't do it with. When I see sometimes the things I do with my wife, I think, geez, if I did this to any of my students, they would leave, and then I have to go apologize. Linda, I'm sorry. But we do this to the people who are closest to us and people who aren't of our tribe. And being bodhisattvas is learning to see that and deal with that and accept it, but also go beyond it. Even if we can go a little bit beyond our hard wiring, that's pretty good. That's pretty good. It makes a difference. So, I'm fictionalizing this, but not a lot. I have a friend named Alan who, pretty good friend, and his brother, who was 67, had cancer. And Alan was getting to ready to put his brother in a nursing home, and his brother committed suicide. And Alan has always been really compassionate guy. He's really helped me a lot at my other nonprofit, done lots and lots of things to really help me. But in the month since his brother's died, he hasn't been able to feel compassion for his brother. He just hasn't been able to. Too close. He's got all kinds of feelings swirling around. He doesn't even talk about them. He seems composed. He did the whole service at the church composed. Well, that's his self-protective mechanism. That's his defenses. We need to have good defenses. Ego is important in Buddhism. Don't throw out ego. My friend Alan has developed good defenses so he can set that boundary, so he can do that. But I know that at some point this stuff is going to come out. And he has a meditation practice. So if he keeps up with his meditation practice, at some point he'll see these things. At some point he'll see his anger. At some point he'll see his sadness, and he'll really feel them. And as he gets some clarity, he will be able to be compassionate to his brother, for sure. But it might take a while. So the practice of meditation is what? Zen meditation, really, regardless how you do it, especially the part which is not just the concentration part, is coming close to suffering. Coming close to and seeing into and seeing through that dizzy karmic consciousness. That dizzy karmic consciousness that we all have. Coming close to that anger. Coming close to that apathy. Coming close to that frustration. Coming close to that jealousy. Coming close to that boredom. With no comment, with no criticism. So close to it that the compassion comes up. That's really all there is to it, so that we can learn to open our hearts and not have to close down to people who aren't of our tribe, to people who are too close to us, to people who did bad things to us, like left the world when we were taking care of him, just when he was taking care of his brother best. He'd given his whole self to his brother. His brother decided, I'm out of here. So he is shaken, and he has to protect himself. By not showing that. And that's fine. That's fine. In its own time, this meditation works. In its own time, we can and will be able to just have an open heart more of the time. Just an easy open heart more of the time. So Zen meditation then, for me, meditation is a gift to compassion. It's the gift we give compassion. And it's very hard for compassion to fully bloom if we don't give it the gift of meditation, of zazen. And whatever form your zazen takes, it doesn't have to take a specific form. So now I want to talk a little bit more about Shantideva, since I'm talking about Mahayana today. And I want to read a little bit again of what he was saying. Shantideva, again. A couple of paragraphs here that I read already. Raining down a flood of food and drink, may I dispel the ills of thirst and famine, and in the ages marked by scarcity and want, may I myself appear as drink and sustenance. For sentient beings poor and destitute, may I become a treasure ever plentiful, and lie before them closely in their reach, a varied source of all that they might need. So, how does this help? I mean, what's he saying here that's helpful in on the Bodhisattva path? Well, two things I think he's saying. One is, he's saying that we need to go where the pain is the most. We need to help. We need to just gravitate to the most pain and really be there. Really be there with a stillness and an open heart. Usually, it takes, again, an open heart to do this. It takes a still mind to do this. But whenever possible, we need to gravitate to where people are suffering the most. And we do. There's a natural inclination in what we call our Buddha nature, just to feel that real raw pain and want to be with it with someone. Especially if our ego doesn't get involved. We don't have to defend because it's our own brother, or we don't have to be angry because it's Dick Cheney. And of course we don't ever have to do those things. We're just hardwired to do those things. But our meditation, we begin to see that hardwiring and actually be free of it. Actually be free of it. So, as many of you know, or some of you know, I've spent most of my a large part of my career working with people with serious mental illness, working, developing programs for, advocating for people with serious depression, people with bipolar disorders, people with schizophrenia, people with anxiety disorders, you name it. That's been a big part of my career. And I'm just happy that I'm able to do it still. It's something I really care about. But when I came to work to the agency that I'm at now, more than 10 years ago, I realized that I had been ignoring, and I've talked about this before, and overlooking people who lived outside, people who were homeless. I had done all this work, but I was a good little social worker, a good psychologist. I saw my clients. I did who was referred to me. But I went to this drop-in center at the agency that I worked for, and I saw, at the drop-in center, I saw all these people. This is for people with mental illness, but I saw all these people waiting to use the washing machine. And another group of people lined up to use the shower. And I said to the woman who was directing the drop-in center, I said, "What's the deal here? I thought this was a program for people with mental illness. Where do these people all come from?" She said, "Oh, Tim, these people live outside, and they're all mentally ill too. And here I've been doing this work for how many years? I always thought it was a bunch of drunks that lived outside." bunch of drunks, and of course a lot of them are drunks, but I had never occurred to me. All this work we'd done for 20 years with people with mental illness, and we'd ignored the fact that most people who live outside, a Wilder study say that 80 to 85% of people who live outside self-identify as having depression, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, anxiety disorder. So if 80 to 85% self-identify, what percent of those folks who live outside really have mental illness and are masking their symptoms with whatever they can get, right? Whatever they can get. So that was a rude awakening to me. Sometimes the biggest suffering is we can't deal with it. We just can't deal with it. That homeless person, yucca. What do I do? It makes me feel awkward. I still feel awkward. What should I do? My staff always say, well, carry fruit around, Tim. Because if you carry money, you know, they're just so many of them are chemically dependent. But I never remember my fruit. So I never know what to do. So this is our bodhisattva life, to pay attention to these things. And to use our zazen to open our hearts by stilling our minds so we can deal with these things. And then the other thing that the Shantideva is talking about here is he's talking about taking the form of the person who's suffering. That's the way. That's the way Avalokiteshvara does it, to take the form of the person who's suffering, to take that form. I mean, you don't get attached to it because you're just taking it, but you take their form. Any other kind of compassionate activity doesn't work. You have to empty yourself and take their form. Not time and time again. That's what the sutras tell us. Time and time again. So when I went to the homeless camps, and I haven't been there lately, my friend would tell me, Tim, you know, get rid of that sports coat. No sports coat. Said, Tim, don't give him any advice. Just come with me now. Sit down. If they give you a dirty cup of coffee, take the dirty cup of coffee. Listen and see what they want, but nothing more. They don't want to be treated. You know, people don't like to be treated. When we treat someone, that person is lower than us. We treat them. I know how to treat you. I'm the bodhisattva around here. People don't like to be treated. That's why they're living outside already. They've been treated within an inch of their lives, you guys. A lot of them are veterans. Get me out of this treatment so I can be who I am. Even if it's drunk, at least that's who I am. But it's not really who they are, because they're scared. Because they're masking. We mask in so many different ways. We defend in so many different ways. But we know how to mask, too, so we don't need to think of their masking as being any different than ours. It's just maybe a little more self-injurious. We want to have healthy defense, healthy masking. So far, my friend Alan has been healthy in his masking, but I'm waiting for him to punch a wall or punch somebody, because I know how angry he is about his brother. He is. And who wouldn't be? We're human beings. At his brother. He's at his brother. So, acting as whole body mind. Francis Cook says, compassion, and we talk about this in our morning study group, is nothing other than spontaneity and self-forgetfulness. Acting with whole body mind as much as possible. As much as possible. And the caveat is, and in Zen, you know, there is always a caveat, because as soon as we have one idea about how we should live, then I need to show the caveat. I need to revolve myself and help you revolve so you don't get stuck on it, right? Because it's such a sticky world the ego lives in, always getting stuck. So the caveat is the drawback to Shantideva, and really why I'm not taught Shantideva, but I'm ready to teach Shantideva now for a while. Till people get to like him too much. The drawback of Shantideva is what? One, too easy to read in, my needs are not important. My needs are not important. Compassion to me is not important. I'll just give everything to you. I'll just let you have everything. You're the one who's suffering. I am beyond that. I'm the bodhisattva beyond compare. You get that feeling with Shantideva often, that he expects us to be the bodhisattva beyond compare. You can read him that way. Well, that's a little dangerous, you guys. A little bit dangerous. Pretty soon, what do we have? martyrs. Remember, we had that in our Christian heritage too, remember? And Buddhists have been known that to do that too, right? Even though supposedly Buddha did not get crucified, a lot of Buddhists have crucified themselves. I'm talking figuratively rather than literally, because they're not good enough, and they want to embrace this wonderful teaching, so they don't take care of themselves. They're not compassionate to their own needs. That's first drawback. Second drawback is, this is the problem with all religion. I should. Tapes begin to dominate. I should do this. I should do that. I should be like him. I should follow him. If only I were like Roshi so-and-so, or Bishop so-and-so, or da-da-da so-and-so. I should. And where's the heart then? We left out the heart. We've forgotten it. We thought we were doing it to open the heart, weren't we? Didn't we think that? We did. We started off with that kind of intention. But then something got mixed up. It always gets mixed up, doesn't it? My goodness. We're something, aren't we? We are something. And then the third one I won't talk much about today. Simple codependence. That's just the other difficulty with taking Shantideva too seriously. Simple codependence, right? I help you because I need to help you. So, Dogen, who sometimes is my hero and sometimes not my hero, depending on the day and the reading, and but for the moment, he will be my hero. It's good to have some heroes for a while. Dogen says, yes, we need to, and I talked about this 3 or 4 weeks ago, yes, we need to practice meditation to clarify our vision, to clear our vision out so we can be clear-eyed on the one hand. On the other hand, he says, we are always conditioned by dim-sightedness as human beings. This is the human condition, dim-sightedness. Dim-sightedness. There is ambiguity, there is elusiveness, and there's all of this stuff. And we can accept that. It's possible for us to accept that in our meditation, in our lives. It's possible to go beyond accepting and actually embracing it, because it's what is. It's what is. And that's when Dogen, and I talked about this last time, talks about using night eyes. We need to learn how to use our night eyes. Our day eyes. This Dogen doesn't talk about this, but this is my... that's all he says, night eyes, but then... In preparing my talks, right, I think about things. When you have to give talks, you're supposed to think about things. But don't do 2 minute shooting. Just sort of do it. Just sort of do it with lightness. Anyway, our day eyes, what are our day eyes like? They're always trying to figure things out. They're always focused on getting something. They've got it, getting the right view, getting toward this goal. In daylight, we can do it. We can see that goal. We can move toward it. We can see the impediments. We got it. It's almost there. It's almost there. Right? Night eyes have to be soft eyes. They have to be soft eyes. You can't figure it out. You can't figure it out. You can feel all around you. You never know. You have to be pretty still with your night eyes. Your day eyes, you don't have to be still. Don't be still. You can have all kinds of things going on because you can see all with your night eyes. You have to be pretty still, pretty soft. Till you begin to appreciate the darkness, appreciate that there's never darkness without light. Never light without darkness. And the second caveat, I know I've talked about a lot of caveats already. The final caveat. The final until next time, right? Till the next thought, right? The final caveat is that dizzy karmic consciousness never goes away. I have been practicing for 41 years. Or something like that. Now let's see, 1964. Well, I took a break of about 4 years. 40 years. Okay. Of course, I'm impure. Maybe a pure person. You need a pure teacher. Find a pure teacher. Good luck. Good luck. Good luck on that one, you guys. Really? Good luck. Dizzy karmic consciousness is the way it is. We have, says Dogen. Zen teachers, he says, have dizzy karmic consciousness. Zen teachers can be more aware of their dizzy karmic consciousness in their zazen, can be more accepting of it, can be more even appreciative of that woo, 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 woo that human beings do. Known by other names, and in most of Buddhism we want to get rid of it. We want to transcend it. We want to nirvana it. Enlighten it. And of course we do enlighten it in Mahayana, but we enlighten it in the dark. No difference. No difference. We darken it in the light. No difference. No difference. That's the problem of you human beings. We forget that. We forget that. So, when I gave a talk about 3 weeks ago, maybe 4 weeks ago, right after the Republican National Convention here, did any of you hear? How many of you heard me give that talk? Okay, well, here it goes again, you guys. You can leave the room if you want. So, a peace march. I went on a peace march, just like 41 years ago. I didn't want to go on the peace march. My son talked me into going. I don't like peace marches. But I've been to quite a few of them the last 41 years. People are always talking me into doing it. So I went on a peace march. Over by the Capitol. And it was very peaceful for a while. And I felt good. It was a good day, and I was with my son, and we were with lots of people, and we were being nice and quiet. We were not raucous like those 20, you know, whatever, 24-year-olds back in Stanford in the 60s. Those were raucous guys and girls. No, we were nice. We were polite. We were just doing our thing. And then we went around a few corners, and then what did I see in front of me? Riot guards. It looked to me like it was the same riot guards as 41 years ago. They had the same huge masks on. They had the same hoods. They had the same billy clubs. They had guns in their holsters. And we were going toward them. And I thought, you know, I couldn't believe it. Everybody was calm. I did see that there were a couple people who were out of the line, who were sort of cutting up. And I saw a little tear gas off of a distance, but it wasn't our group. But so we had this huge phalanx of riot guards who were then making us go through really narrow entryways. They weren't doing anything to us, but we had to go through a narrow entryway like this. There were probably 800 or 900 of us, and the riot guards were right next to us. So there I was again with my dizzy karmic consciousness 41 years later. It was just there again. The fear was there again. The upsetness was there. They're like, what is going on here? And then there was the deja vu all over again, as Yogi Berra would say. What is the deal here? But at the same time, it was different. It was different. It was different because all I needed to do was take one breath and look at the sky, and I felt some love for those guys in those hot uniforms. I tried to look in their eyes, but it was hard to see their eyes because they had this big guard thing. I wanted to see into their eyes because I knew this was hard for them. I knew they were not having a good time. It was a warm day, and they were dressed in all this. And I was sure they didn't want to be mean, although they sure looked mean. and I felt great love for them. Great love. Until my dizzy karmic consciousness started again. And that's the way life is, isn't it? That's the way life is. But more and more in our practice, we can just be with what is. And if it's dizzy, right there in the dizziness is the stillness. It's there. It's not anywhere else. You'll never find it anywhere else. You won't. You just won't. It's good for you to practice. It's good for you to meditate. It's good for you to be compassionate. But you will only find stillness right here in this dizziness. In this dizziness, there is no dizziness. There is no trace of dizziness in this dizziness. Because it's just what is. It doesn't know. So it doesn't have to get tossed away by it. It's just a wonderful painting, continually in process. Boy, a lot of abstract art there that seems kind of violent, but psh, 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 psh. And then it'll turn impressionistic for a while. Back to a little Monet to relieve myself as I breathe. And then a little more Kandinsky again. And a little more, who was that? Well, Munch again. Oh, that's life. That's our consciousness, right? You won't get anything else. You want something else? Not as a human being. But this is where you find your tranquility, in this, not someplace else. So that's our vow, to be compassionate to this, to be compassionate to our own suffering self, to our own dizzy self, to our own dizzy brother, my own dizzy brother who committed suicide. How dare he do that to me? How dare he do that? That's my dizzy self, right? Sentient beings are numberless. I vow to freedom. Sentient beings are numberless. We vow to freedom. Okay. What else? Comments? Questions? Justice and injustice, and what else?
Or is that just dizziness too?
Justice and injustice. She wants me to speak to the issue of justice and injustice, or is that not, or is that just dizziness too? Well, you know, that's an interesting question. For me, justice is a manifestation of, it's a an intellectual written, sometimes written in laws, sometimes intellectual manifestation of deep caring. And deep caring is a manifestation of an open heart. And injustice is not... injustice happens when we conceal, when we cover over our natural open-heartedness. And this process of self-emptying, opening the heart, seeing the dizziness, seeing how dizziness, if it's goes runs rampant, causes injustice. Dizziness, which we're hypnotized by, causes injustice by its very nature because it's so desperate. It so much wants to be loved and appreciated and valued, and its tribe, its ego, its country, that it causes injustice. So justice comes only when we see this dizzy consciousness, when we acknowledge it, when we accept it. And when we do that, we don't need to be hypnotized by it. We don't need to. We don't need to be, it doesn't need to be a predator. Too often, dizzy consciousness is a predator, and it's always creating injustice. But dizzy consciousness does not need to be a predator. It can just be movement. It can just be life, if we see it, if we appreciate it for what it is, accept it and then appreciate it. But not in some kind of sentimental way. Oh, there it is. This is really the process of zazen, the process of being here with this anger, being here with this confusion, moment after moment, until there's no longer an identity with it. There's no identification with it. Until there is identification. And then sit with it, be with it, until there's no identification. And that's where compassionate heart comes from. And we want to have compassionate societies. We want to have societies that are just. We all do. How's that? Okay. Anybody else? Other people? Okay.